Mmm, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Hi, this is Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop. Thanks for joining me for this episode of the Sonic Scoop podcast. Today, we've got a topic that's once again near and dear to my heart. Once again, a misunderstood topic. We're going to be talking about practicing. Practicing in the world of music, in the world of audio engineering and music production as well. I think this is another one of those things where people sometimes mean different things when they say the word practice. And I think that there are right and productive ways to practice and terrible ways to practice, things that aren't practicing. And I think a lot of us haven't practiced as much as we think we have, haven't practiced as much as we should. Don't worry, this is not going to be a downer of a podcast. I'm not going to be here scolding you, telling you to practice like your parents did and you never did or whatever it was. But to be honest, that's actually true for a surprising number of musicians. A lot of musicians out there are fairly talented people and go through this process where they got good at an instrument pretty fast without a lot of practice and didn't develop good practice habits. And this is extremely true for kind of rock and pop musicians. I know because I'm kind of in this category myself. It wasn't until much later in life that I discovered the power of practice. And I discovered why I hadn't done it right up until then. And I kind of finally understood how important it was when I finally worked practicing in the right ways into my life. Oh my goodness, my level of craft, my level of mastery over what I was trying to do got so much better. My life got easier. I got more pleased with the results. So no, I'm not here to scold you into practice. I'm not your dad. I'm not your mom. I'm here though to give you some advice, some insights, and some research on not only the powers of practice, but also if you're going to do it, how to get into a rhythm doing it and how to do it the most effectively. And not only am I going to have some advice here for artists and musicians and even songwriters and composers, but also for producers and engineers, people working in audio, and even if you work in a field other than music and sound, so much of this you can take away into the rest of your life, even into things like business. All right, well, let's dive into it. I wrote two really big, really researched stories on this a while back in Trust Me, I'm a Scientist, my blog that I have where we ported most of these stories over to Sonic Scoop since then. But I did a pair of articles, I believe it was back in late 2013, called How to Become the Best at What You Do in Music, in Sound, or Anything Else, and What to Practice, How Musicians, Producers, Audio Engineers, and Even Entrepreneurs Can Improve Their Craft. And we went to a lot of data there. This was around the time that 10,000-hour rule was really getting popularized. You've probably heard of it. A guy named Erickson, a scientist, did a whole bunch of studies around practice. And we've coined from it this whole 10,000 hours rule thing. You've probably heard of it saying that 10,000 hours is really what you need to put in to become a master of your craft. It's actually a little bit of a misnomer. And the reality around it is a little bit more complex than that. There are certain things where a lot of people have been practicing for a long time, say, being a concert pianist, where it takes more than 10,000 hours to put you near the top of the craft compared to everyone else, because everyone else has practiced 10,000 hours who's near the top of the craft. So it's the people who have practiced 13,000 hours and 15,000 hours and 18,000 hours who are, you know, bringing home more of the accolades. And then there's other things where fewer people have practiced it, like memorizing random digits, where you can spend a few hundred hours and be one of the masters in the world at memorizing random digits. Maybe it's more than a few hundred hours by now, because since I read that statistic, maybe more people have studied how to memorize random digits and are better at it now. So there's really a floating target. And this is one of the great things that I want to hammer home for you, is that practice doesn't have to be boring. It doesn't have to be rote. It doesn't have to be about learning to do the things that everyone else is doing. One of the amazing shortcuts to practice and in practice is to focus only on practicing those things that A, you actually need to work on, and B, that give you a real advantage. you may be the kind of person who wants to practice at becoming a great concert pianist, playing the same classical tunes as everyone else before you, and you'll need to put in lots and lots of hours doing that. But if you find a different niche, a niche where there isn't as much competition, you can get to that same level of mastery within your niche in many, many fewer hours. And that's one of the many, many hacks that we're going to be talking about today. Bobby McFerrin, I believe, singer, you might have heard of this guy. He did that song, Don't Worry, Be Happy. Everyone's heard Don't Worry, Be Happy. If you're my age, you probably heard it, you know, when it was actually a pop hit and you thought, oh, this cheesy thing. But I got to tell you, I rediscovered that song later in life. Makes me want to cry every time I hear it. It's a fantastic song. And Bobby McFerrin is actually an amazingly talented singer. I don't care if you're into death metal or hip hop or jazz or what you're into. Go listen to some Bobby McFerrin. This guy is an acrobat and a master in his craft, if you actually hear some of his deep cuts. And I'm not going to be able to cite this for you, but I remember reading somewhere in an interview at some point with him where he talked about locking himself up for 2 hours a day for, you know, 4 or 5 days a week for, you know, a year or two. And that really being where his album came out of and kind of where some of his mastery came out of that let him do his first record. And that is what practice can look like. It can look like having an amazing degree of success without, you know, practicing 8 or 10 hours a day. You hear these stories of people out in the woodshed practicing 8 or 10 hours a day. First of all, you don't need to do that. Second of all, there's evidence to show it's probably a bad idea because you can't really do very productive practice for 8 or 10 hours straight. And in fact, although some of the best people out there in their craft are often those who practice the most, they're not necessarily the ones logging the most hours on a day-by-day basis. They're the ones doing it most consistently. And that is really the big thing when it comes to practice, is building the habit. You are better off practicing 5 days a week for 15 minutes a day, ideally for 30 minutes a day, no, ideally for an hour a day, no, ideally for 2 hours a day. We'll keep on moving that up as you get longer, but you're better off practicing for 15 minutes a day and working your way up than trying to jump into a 2 hour a day practice habit that you simply cannot sustain. And that is where a lot of people go wrong in practice. And it's where a lot of false starts happen. This assumption that I'm supposed to jump in, practicing at least 30 minutes a day, practicing at least an hour a day is good. Let's jump in there and do it. And then they fizzle out immediately because they have trouble building in that habit. If you can build in the habit of sitting down to practice 5 minutes a day, you can even say, I don't even have to practice. I just need to sit down at the thing I want to practice for 5 minutes. And you can do that every day for a week, 5 days a week, or you could do it 6 days a week. Then my goodness, sitting there for 10 minutes isn't going to be that much harder. And then once you're sitting there for 5 or 10 minutes, even if you don't play a thing, well, you're going to be bored out of your skull if you don't do a thing. So you may as well do something. And that is actually a little tidbit of advice I learned from a book called Effortless Mastery, which is a book by a musician. It's also read by a lot of people in other fields, but that was one of his pieces of advice. And I really liked it a lot. It really stuck with me, that idea of just showing up. If you're having trouble with a practice habit, sit down for 5 minutes and say, I don't even have to practice, but I can't do anything else. And then trust me, within that 5 minutes, you're going to do some practice. And all of a sudden, that 5 minutes turns into 10 or 15. And you don't end up feeling frustrated with yourself. You end up feeling happy, excited. You exceeded your expectations. And that's a big thing when it comes to practice, or really meeting any goal, is setting up small goals that you can achieve and accomplish, and making it habitual, making it constant in your life. Well, I've dived right into some of these tactics already without establishing some of the whys, and I really want to give you a sense for just how important this stuff is. So I'm going to read for you a little excerpt from this article I did called How to Become the Best at What You Do. Dr. Erickson began releasing some of the most groundbreaking research in this area back in the early 1990s, and since then, further studies have repeatedly confirmed his basic findings. Now, after nearly 3 decades of study, it appears that there are 3 things that lead to great performance in any given field. 1, how much you practice. 2, how you practice. And 3, whether the conditions around you are conducive to you practicing. And that's just about it. Sure, some of us may have aptitudes or physical constraints that make us better fit for one field or another. Unless you're well over 6 feet tall, you may have a disadvantage as a linebacker or an NBA star, although there are exceptions. See Muggsy Bogues, one of my favorite basketball players of all time, for instance. Similarly, if you're anywhere near 6 feet tall, you're probably at a huge disadvantage as a gymnast or dancer. But most fields aren't like gymnastics or basketball. In all the research that's been done, there's barely any evidence to suggest that talent, as we commonly understand it, really exists. That is to say, no one has discovered a gene that leads people to becoming a master oboist, typist, mathematician, salesperson, songwriter, or chess champion instead of something else. Now, this is not to say that talent isn't a thing at all, just that it isn't the sole contributing factor in making people great at what they do. There may be a difference in talent, in aptitude from person to person, but the effects of this seem to largely be canceled out by how long someone is applying themselves within a given field. Every once in a while, there'll be a study that comes out that tries to show that, hey, talent is a big deal too. And a lot of these studies are just not as powerful as the ones that stress practice, that stress you actual application of your aptitudes. For instance, there was one that I read in the New York Times, it was 2011, some author there wrote an article called Sorry Strivers, Talent Still Matters. And they cited this study where two sets of piano players were compared, and they had these piano players who either were said to have high working memory. This is something not related to piano playing, just how many random digits they can memorize, that kind of thing, or low working memory. And they found that when they were judged by a panel of, you know, people who know piano music on how well they sight read from a score, the ones who were in the high working memory group performed about 7% better than those in the low working memory group. Aha! So their innate talent at memorizing random stretches of numbers and other things gave them an edge. Their raw natural talent gave them a 7% edge over these other performers. What this article neglected to mention was that in the study, there was a high practice group of piano players and a low practice group of piano players. And the piano players in the high practice group performed 100% better than the performers in the low practice group. So they were twice as accurate, twice as good at reading from a score. And then among those who practiced a lot in a similar range, some of them had better working memory and also did 7% better. So yes, is there a chance that talent plays a role? Maybe. And maybe it plays a role in distinguishing out of the, you know, the 10 best piano players in the world who most people vote as number one out of them. Maybe it has some effect there. And maybe it has some effect in people getting started and going down the road of practicing more. But clearly, you can take people who have different aptitudes. You can take someone who has a high aptitude and doesn't practice, and someone who has a lower aptitude and practices all the time, and the person with a lower aptitude who practices all the time, most likely going to do better. And this seems to be true across fields, with there being obviously some examples you can throw out and quibble about. If you want to really get this point driven into your brain, if you feel like you need this repeated to you and you need to see more evidence about how important this is, I recommend you check out that article, How to Become the Best at What You Do in Music, Sound, or Anything Else. I'll link to that in the show notes. But assuming that you're with me on this and you want a little bit more info on the hows and the whats to practice, let's dive right into it. First of all, how much practice do you need? Here's an excerpt from that article. So like I mentioned, the most commonly cited number is this 10,000 hours of practice. I think it's a bit of a misnomer and can vary depending on what field you're in. But let's take 10,000 just because it's a nice round number. That amounts to 10 hours of practice a week for 20 years or 20 hours a week for 10 years. So if you think you can catch up by practicing 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, forget about it. Research shows that past 4 hours a day, additional practice, at least on a musical instrument, becomes pretty ineffective. Even much past 2 or 2.5 hours a day, students will often begin to see diminishing returns from further practice. So if your goal is to become a world-class instrumentalist, maybe that's not your goal, but if it were, Chances are you can't slack off too much from the figures of 10,000 hours. What you can do is work smarter. There's evidence to suggest that musicians who practice slightly less than their peers can do just as well, so long as they use that time more effectively. There's a violinist quoted to say, "Practice with your fingers and you need all day. Practice with your mind and you will do just as much in 1.5 hours." I think that's pretty powerful. He may exaggerate slightly, but there's truth in that. So let's look at what kind of practice is most likely to lead to you succeeding at your goals. You may have heard of this term before. It is called deliberate practice. So first of all, there's a conventional view of what practicing should look like. And maybe this is the view that you were hammered over the head with when you were younger, and maybe it's even stopped you from practicing. It looks something like this. When you think of what a practice session is supposed to be, chances are that you might imagine warming up on some scales, mindlessly playing through some finger exercises, and then beginning to work on a piece of music that you want to improve on. Maybe you'd start playing a new piece from the beginning, as fast as you're comfortable doing, till you come to a part where you make a mistake. Then you might tread back over that mistake a few times until it starts to feel right. Then you'd move on until you get to the next mistake and go back over that one a bit until it smooths out. This style of practice is common, it's intuitive, and it's almost exactly wrong. It has very little to do with the kind of practice that top performers engage in. Based on the research, here are the 5 hallmarks to what good practice looks like on any instrument or in any field. Number 1, focus on what needs improving. One of the key differences is that great performers don't spend much time practicing things that they can already do. When learning an instrument, too many people practice by playing the things that they're already good at. Great performers, on the other hand, spend their time working on only the things that need work. Ineffective performers will often practice whole pieces at full speed, hoping they'll improve the weak sections by mere repetition, or perhaps by osmosis. Unfortunately, this kind of practice can even reinforce mistakes rather than ironing them out. There's even a saying among teachers in the know: practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes permanent. But you can't just jump into the hardest section of a piece and just start flailing around either. Instead, you need to do something else. And before I go into that, I'm going to give you a much belated sponsors shout out. So a big shout out to our sponsors on this week's podcast. Once again, sponsoring Eventide Audio. Man, Eventide, they make some of the best hardware and software effects out there. Really interesting stuff. If you haven't checked them out, go to eventideaudio.com. You can download anything they make for free, like Fission and their structural effects line, where you can affect your transients and your sustain separately. Really interesting stuff. They have a ton of great effects pedals, a ton of killer reverbs like Black Hole, Mangled Verb, just really unique, interesting stuff. Also, in a similar boat, Soundtoys. You can try out anything they make for free at soundtoys.com, one of my favorite plugin companies around. Their whole bundle is worth having. If you don't have it, go out and get it. If you want to try some stuff, go on soundtoys.com, try out anything they make for free. Too much fun. You're really going to love this stuff. Last but not least, this is brought to you by Mixing Breakthroughs, my course that will teach you to get better at mixing through what? Through practice. Through what kind of practice? My goodness, through the kind of deliberate practice we're talking about in this article. It's a really unique course. Instead of watching me mouse around on a screen for a while, you instead have me as your mixing coach, putting you through the paces, practicing the skills you need to hone to get better at mixing. If you do the course and the exercises in this course, there is absolutely no question that you will get better at mixing. So check it out at mixingbreakthroughs.com. If you're more interested in mastering, you can check out masteringdemystify.com. That's also a good one. All right, back to it. So number 1, we will focus on what needs improving. Number 2, when you're practicing, break down the work into manageable sections, keeping the goal within reach. Although great performers tend to put in the most hours, they don't measure their practice sessions in mere time. They measure it in accomplishments. For instance, if you wanted to master a new and challenging song on the piano, a bad idea would be to jump right into the hardest part and go at it full tempo with both hands, hoping that enough repetitions would make it all gel. Instead, you'd want to break the piece down by focusing on just the right hand, then just the left hand, then both hands together, but at a very slow tempo. Only once you've mastered all three stages, and I mean really mastered them, is it time to move on. Before playing faster, you should start to feel bored by how easily you can do it. Then make your task more interesting by clicking up the tempo a notch, always keeping just one step ahead of boredom so that you're always just barely reaching, straining, and striving to get over the next hurdle. When learning an instrument, one of the most common problems is that students will rush too far ahead after a few hasty and half-realized successes, thinking, I've got this. I'm different. I'm talented. Oh man, I've been there. Inevitably, these students end up hitting a wall that they can't surmount through this ultimately futile method. Then, faced with a level of difficulty for which they are completely unprepared, they become endlessly frustrated and simply give up. This type of futile reproach is responsible for more half-learned pieces and more stalled careers in any field than almost anything else. This is important to recognize because when it comes to deliberate practice, here's number three. You can't do it when you're frustrated. And this is a big thing. These are premises that apply to really any skill, whether you're practicing music, learning how to mix, writing an article, running a business, whatever. For the moment, let's continue with this analogy of music lessons because it's something most of us listening to this podcast can probably relate to. So this is one of the big things, is that the kind of deliberate practice we're talking about, you really get shut down from it when you're going in from a place of frustration, a place of angst. This is one of the reasons that breaks are important, and it's one of the reasons that you can't do it literally all day. And it's also one of the reasons that you end up kind of hitting a wall sometimes on a mix if you're on that end of things. Number four is you can only do deliberate practice for a while at a time, as I've just suggested. And here's the other big thing. Number five is that you need immediate feedback. And feedback can come in the form of a teacher, it can come in the form of a recording, but you need it and you need it often in order to improve. Most people freeze up or become uncomfortable when they first try recording themselves, whatever the task may be. And that's normal and it's a necessary step. Instead of hating the camera or audio recorder for making you choke up, embrace it for letting you know how you really sound under pressure. Without first confronting reality, there is no hope of moving forward. In order to gain perspective, performers need to see themselves perform. Mixers need to print their mixes and listen to them away from the desk. Writers need to mark a draft done and come back to it later. It's also important to get constructive criticism from people you trust and respect. Just make sure that they and you know what constructive means. When people tell you about a place in your work where they get bored, believe them. Then consider whether or not they're your target audience. And if they are, take that criticism seriously. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about how important it is to practice and what deliberate practice looks like. And I'll tell you, the word practice is used in a few different ways. The word practice is used to describe mindlessly warming up on chords and scales, getting in your 30 minutes, playing through a piece haphazardly, making a mistake, going back and fixing the mistake and all that. That's not the kind of practice that works for learning an instrument. It's not the kind of practice that really works for getting good at anything. There's another kind of practice, this deliberate practice that we're talking about, where you figure out what are those things that I really need to improve that will make me better at achieving the goals that I want to achieve. And chances are, if you're listening to this, your goal is not to become the best violinist or grand chess master or tennis player or concert pianist in the world. You're not looking for a virtuosic, you know, degree of success where you're competing against others and your accuracy and feeling on playing pieces that a whole bunch of other people learn how to play. That's not what most people in music want. However, we can learn a lot from people who take that path. There's a lot to learn from what they do. So let me give you a few ideas, whether you're a more conventional musician in the pop world or the hip-hop world or the EDM world, or if you're in MySpace, the music production and audio engineering space. So there's another article I wrote that goes along with this one called What to Practice, How Musicians, Producers, Audio Engineers, and Entrepreneurs Can Improve Their Craft. And here are a couple things I recommend. So first of all, when it comes to audio and sound, learning your frequencies might help. This is the most obvious one, right? Oh, can you differentiate 500 hertz from 1,000 hertz? Those frequencies are far enough from each other that you should have a good sense. I think you don't necessarily need to learn, you know, whether something is 1,000 hertz or 1,100 hertz. That level of fine granularity isn't that big. But what you should get a sense for is at least the overall frequency ranges. And I would say there's a few of them. There is your bass, your mid-range, and your top end, right? And you can further subdivide those into a couple of categories. When you have identified something as being in the bass and not in the mid-range, what part of the bass? I would say there's two parts, the sub-bass and the upper bass. Your sub-bass might be those frequencies, say, below 80 or 60 hertz. Below 60 in particular is definitely subs. And that has a totally different feeling and a totally different role in the mix or in the recording than your upper bass. Maybe those frequencies that are 80 or 100 hertz all the way up to 200 or so hertz. Really different role in the mix. And getting those areas into balance from an arrangement perspective, from a production perspective, from a recording perspective, or a mixing perspective is really big. So again, it's not necessarily that crucial to be able to immediately by ear differentiate 45 hertz from 46 hertz. That isn't helping anyone. But becoming really familiar and developing a sense memory for, ooh, those are the subs. Oh, that's the upper bass. Oh, this problem is likely to be somewhere between 40 and 60. This problem is likely to be somewhere between 100 and 200. That's the kind of stuff. And the further up you go, the bigger and wider apart those numbers get. So in the mid-range arguably encompasses everything from 200 or 300 hertz to maybe 5,000, 6,000 hertz. These are somewhat arbitrary distinctions. You know, the lines are blurred. But obviously the low mid-range between, say, 300 and 500 hertz plays a very different role than the upper mid-range of, say, 2K to 5K. And you should develop a sense memory for those ranges. Do you need absolute precision if you are recording or mixing in recognizing things by ear? Not necessarily, but working on having some precision at knowing them by ear will help you become intimately familiar with those ranges. So when you hear an issue, you immediately can suss out, is that a high frequency problem or is it really a high mid-range problem? Or is it really a problem where I have too much stuff in the lower mid-range? And getting a sense there can be big. And there's a lot of apps out there to help you train your ears. In fact, we have an article that's all about the top ear training apps on Sonic Scoop. Who would have figured? Same thing with compression, learning to hear the difference in attack times and to hear the difference in release times. That's big. And these are things you can do deliberate ear training practice on if you're in the world of music production, audio engineering, that kind of thing. You could do some sessions where you really just sit there with material and play around with just this variable of the attack time. You set a medium fast release and you start to play with a fast attack, a slow attack, until you really start to hear at the same amount of compression, what does a fast attack sound like? What is it doing to the front end of your sound? Is it smoothing things out? Is it shaving off some transient? Is it making the dynamics even more consistent? What's the slow attack doing? Is it bringing out more punch, more articulation, but is it allowing maybe things to be a little bit more dynamic and a little less controlled? So there's advantages and disadvantages to each. So that is another place. This is only the start. Oh man, I could go on, and I do in this article. Other things you could check out would be reverb times. Can you get a sense for how long is a reverb time? Is it a second? Is it a second and a half? Is it 2 seconds? Is it a half second? Delays as well. Listening to delays and figuring out what's going on here? Is there some type of filter that's carving out high frequencies or low frequencies? How many repeats is in this delay? Doing this kind of deliberate ear training is possible. There are apps to help with this, and you can also make exercises for yourself. But before I go into this even further, I want to stress that this kind of deliberate practice is not the only way of practicing. Practicing really means putting into action. Let's look up the etymology of the word practice in my favorite online etymology dictionary. I do have a favorite etymology dictionary, and it is not Merriam-Webster. It's this wonderful website called the Online Etymology Dictionary, E-T-Y-M Online. So practice, to do, to act, to follow or employ, to carry on a profession. That is how it was used at least circa 1400. It comes from late Latin practicus or practical. See, practical. Where does that word come from? dealing with practical matters, applied, not merely theoretical, fit for action, fit for business, businesslike, active, effective, vigorous, done, to be done, to do, to act, to effect, to accomplish. And that's another big thing in the idea of practice, is practice is not only about repeating something for skill. That is a newer definition of the word practice. It arose probably in the 1500s or 1600s, according to this online etymology dictionary, but the original root of this word goes back to just taking something out of the realm of theory and putting it to work. And one of the other best ways to practice is to work for clients. And you will get better working for clients. You'll get that immediate feedback. You'll have a reason to sit down and get into the habit of doing work. So even if you haven't done a ton of deliberate practice, that's okay. If you are getting clients and you have enough competence to get the job done for them, that kind of practice absolutely counts as real practice. So don't think you have to do all this stuff before you get clients. Getting clients and working with them is doing this stuff. And you can also do this kind of deliberate practice while you are working with clients. So I want to make that important distinction. That is the third way of using the word practice that I think a lot of people don't take seriously enough. But whenever you have downtime in the studio, you should be thinking about doing two things. One, finding some clients so you don't have downtime. And two, maybe working in deliberate practice on some of those foundations that you haven't worked on yet. So I want to stress that too. This is not the only way to practice, but it is a great way to build a foundation for your practice in working with clients. And it's a great way to work on your weak spots. I give more examples of how to do this in audio and sound when it pertains to recording and when it pertains to mixing in the article, and also when it pertains to mastering. I want to address the music thing real quick, because I know a lot of people who listen to this podcast are also musicians and work with musicians as producers. So that's a big thing, and I want to talk about that. So for me, the biggest issue for most new bands, most new musical artists, is not their virtuosity and their accuracy on their instrument. The issue is their ability to lock in on a groove. This is one of the most crucial things that separates great artists that make you want to move, that immediately suck you in, from those who are going to remain amateurs for the rest of their lives. And like I've said in the past, it's not bad to be an amateur, but if your goal is to be a professional, one of the things that people are paying for when they are paying musicians is they want to hear a bunch of people kind of all vibrating together at the same frequency. They want to hear people really locking into a groove, becoming an organism together, becoming a sum that is greater than its parts. And to do that, really, the groove, the rhythm, knowing where you should be, knowing where to accent, really moving in lockstep with your musical partners, that's huge. And even if you're making, you know, EDM music, obviously is so into this that it's done on the grid, making sure everything is locked. But even if you're just doing overdubs or constructing music that way, or if you're doing things on the grid, and you're doing things with loop, you need to get a sense for rhythmic feel. So here's one of the ways to work on this really important, really primal, and most essential skills in all of music. So I'm going to read from the article again. Unless you're already a true master, there is no question that your sense of tempo can be better than it is now. Practice to a metronome, often. Get it ingrained in your body and brain. Lock in with it, not like it's some obnoxiously square referee, but it's like it's the damn hippest and most amazing member of your band. And I think that's a big thing for working with a metronome. People often see the metronome as this annoying schoolmarm going tick, 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 play your thing, eat your broccoli. But the metronome isn't that. The metronome is someone going, yeah, all right, we're playing, let's go, come on. Yeah, we're doing it. Are you doing it? I'm doing it. Yeah, let's do it. That's the metronome. Excuse me, my phone is ringing here. The metronome is really the coolest member of the band. You've got to think about the metronome as your friend, going, we're playing. In my honest opinion, if you completely lack the ability to lock yourself in a room with a metronome and keep yourself genuinely entertained with 15 minutes of increasingly complex clapping exercises, then you have absolutely no business playing music. If you've never done that before, it is not too late to start. And if you have done it, now is the time to get better. I go through some examples in the article. There's some really foundational exercises you can do to really lock in, changing back and forth between an eighth note feel and a 16th note feel. Clapping along with a metronome is a great exercise to do, super easy. You know, a seven-year-old can do it, but then you can do more and more complex things where you can go back and forth between a 16th note feel and a triplet feel. And then you can leave out every other triplet when you're going back and forth, and then leave out every other 16th note. So I mentioned some exercises in there that are good to try out. And if you can do these things, clapping, you can bring it onto your instrument. And this is really one of the ways of making sure those fundamental building blocks of groove, knowing how to play in a four feel, knowing how to play, you know, an eighth note feel, a 16th note feel, a triplet feel, and go back and forth between them seamlessly and drop out, you know, particular notes. That is the stuff that all groove is made out of. So getting those building blocks ingrained in you is absolutely huge. If any of that stuff is tricky to do that I detail in the article, then that's good. It means you can get better at it. The same kind of thing can be done with the melodic building blocks of music. Your basic solfege, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, right? Doing that stuff, you know, singing in thirds, do, mi, re, fa, mi, sol, fa, la, that stuff should be easy and natural to you. But so should singing in fourths, singing in fifths, singing in sixths, singing in sevenths, doing your solfege with a flatted seventh, doing solfege in chords. That is stuff that you should be able to kind of jump around on. It'll make it so much easier to find the right note when you're writing, when you're trying to figure out other pieces by ear, when you're trying to find the right note for a melodic line. You have to make sure that those foundational building blocks are so ingrained in you. It'll make you so much more fluid. If you just want to practice clapping exercises to a metronome and basic solfege exercises where you're improving your ability to hear and repeat notes, even if you don't plan to be a singer or a percussionist, those exercises carry over to any instrument. And I really just can't recommend them enough. And I give some proposal exercises in the article there. There's also ways you can practice in songwriting, composition, and arrangement. Here again from the piece, take any melody you like, pre-existing one, and try to write a new arrangement of it in four-part harmony. Then try three voices or just two. Try it with counterrhythms in each of the parts and see what changes. Take a melody that you do know and make a new one out of it using the same notes and durations, but in a completely different order. And here is a big one, I think, for people in music production. Study the form of your favorite songs. Whenever there's a song that moved you to the point where you're like, I have to listen to this again, a big part of that is probably not only the performance, which can be captivating, not only the production, which can make things interesting, but the form of the song often gives it a lot of its pull. So work on checking that out. How many A sections does the song have? How long are the A sections? How about the B sections? How long of an intro is there? Is there a bridge? And when you study this thing in song after song, it'll give you more of a sense of what you might want to do with your songs. Now, I want to offer a caveat here, which is I don't want you to necessarily become too analytical, or I don't want you to become more analytical than your goals dictate. So you take Paul McCartney, who is famous for saying, oh, I never learned how to, you know, I'm not going to do a Paul McCartney impression, but he's famous for saying, oh, I never learned how to, you know, read, write music, you know, do it all from my ear. And great, that's fine. That's not to say he didn't study music. It's not to say he didn't spend countless amount of time putting into practice music. He just didn't use tools of analysis that weren't really necessary to get him closer to his goals. Another thing, though, of course, worth remembering is that when you hear some of these beautiful Beatles arrangements, they weren't written by Paul McCartney. There was a lot of help that came from George Martin, who did have all that kind of training. So Paul McCartney specialized in what he specialized in, which was performing well on mostly bass and as a vocalist, and writing good, strong song structure and good melody and good lyrics. And there are ways to practice doing that. And he probably did some of the kind of analysis that we're talking about of getting a feel for song form and instrumentation and studying other music. He was definitely a listener of other music and a student of other music, even if he wasn't super interested in music notation. We also know he practiced a lot with the Beatles, playing together, developing this kind of rhythmic cohesiveness and a deep familiarity with the fundamental building blocks of melodic and harmonic structure. And again, you don't need to know a ton of music theory and be able to read music at an expert level to do some of these clapping exercises where you really get into mastering eighth notes, mastering 16th notes, mastering triplets, mastering leaving them out, mastering going back and forth between different ones. You don't have to be a music theory nerd to do your solfège, to, you know, sing in thirds, to sing in fourths, to sing in fifths, to sing out the arpeggios of basic chord forms, to make your ear really ready for analyzing and capturing sounds and all of that. Obviously, singing along to some of your favorite works, figuring out some of your favorite works, all of that is a form of deliberate practice. Sitting down with your stereo system and learning note for note the work of others is a big and crucially important way that people teach themselves in popular music. And if you're not doing much of it these days, hopefully it's because you did so much of it in the past that you don't really need to anymore. And the kind of practice that you're doing is the daily practice of setting aside time every week to write, to arrange, to compose, living out your work through actual practice. Practice doesn't have to be this kind of deliberate practice. It can help to do this deliberate practice. But once you've built a good foundation, then your practice can be a daily habit of actually working on making your own music. But just remember, that's a form of practice too. And it really helps if you have a strong foundation. And if you don't have a strong foundation, it's never too late to go back and get a better foundation and really improve at everything that you do. So I hope this has given you some food for thought. I hope this is a good place to start. Like I said, I give even more examples in these two articles. I'll link to in the show notes how to become the best at what you do and what to practice for musicians, producers, audio engineers, and entrepreneurs. I hope you've taken at least an idea or two out of this. And if you want 20 more ideas, go and check out those articles. And if you're really interested in the mixing end of things and you want a course that is really geared around this kind of practice, you got to check out Mixing Breakthroughs. Check it out at mixingbreakthroughs.com. Some people occasionally return this course. You know, maybe, I don't know, whatever, a few percent of people buy it and they use our, you know, satisfaction guarantee. It's because they said, hey man, I thought I was going to watch you mix. And this course, Mixing Breakthroughs, is not about watching me mix. It's about you mixing and getting better at mixing. You could watch a million people mix a million records, and that is not going to make you better at mixing records. What's going to make you better at mixing records is taking what you've learned from others and applying it to your own mixes. And that is what Mixing Breakthroughs is about, is to put this stuff into application right now. If you don't have clients to work with, it gives you exercises that you can work with on any multi-tracks you can get your hands on. And if you do have clients to work with, it's a way to integrate this kind of deliberate practice into your work on their mixes so you can improve while you're delivering work to your clients. So there's a big difference. There's all that theory of, oh, that's a way that you could EQ drums that I'm watching someone do on YouTube. Great. But what's really great is putting that stuff into practice. If you're more interested in that on the mastering side, check out Mastering Demystified, where I do both the theory and the practice. So you get to watch me mastering, but more importantly, I give you ways that you can put this stuff into practice in your own work right now. Also, big shout out and thanks to our sponsors, Eventide. Eventide Audio, check them out, eventideaudio.com, making some really interesting both hardware and software effects for like 40 plus years. They're cutting edge in the 70s and they're cutting edge today. Soundtoy is also one of the best makers of plugins that's currently existing in the universe as of today. Check them out, soundtoys.com. Try out anything they make for free. And to you, happy practicing. Just do it and do it day after day. And the biggest thing is to not do it for 10 hours today. The biggest thing is to do it for 10 hours this week if you can. And if you can't do it for 10 hours this week, to do it for an hour this week by spreading it out day after day, and not trying to do one big 10-hour session. trying to do. If you can only do 5 minutes a day, commit to that. If you can only do 10 minutes a day, commit to that. If you can only do 30 minutes a day, my goodness, if you were to practice an instrument for 30 minutes a day, you would look back after the course of 2 years and say, wow, I can play this thing surprisingly well. That's the thing that most people don't do. But you listening to this, getting this far, I know you're going to do it. So good luck to you. Thanks for hanging out with me. See you next time.